The Judiciary Committee will come to order. Senator Holman, thank you very much for coming to make the quorum. I know you have previous commitments. Appreciate that. The first bill that I would like to take up is Senate Bill 535, a bill which has been before us, one which revises criminal laws in the state. Mr. Hickey, could you come forward for a moment? We've been through this. It seems like an old friend. And let me raise one question that we perhaps didn't completely talk about, and that was the question of what would constitute an offense under the language which defines cable microwave or subscription or television reception.
Yeah.
You and I briefly spoke about that before the committee meeting opened. And like Senator Parr, I'm concerned that if someone had a receiver in Igigig where there's not subscription service and that they not run afoul of the law. On the other hand, we want to prevent the unauthorized use of copyrighted subscriptions or services in the urban areas where they are available for a fee. I realize it may be a close question in this language anyway, whether a person in a far corner of Alaska would be chargeable under this section. However, I think that there are a number of people that wouldn't want the chilling effect of this statute, if that were the case.
I understand what you're saying. Well, since the committee last considered this bill and Senator Parr raised this issue at the time and we discussed it, the previous session, since I spoke today, I took another more careful look at the statute. And really, the key language in the statute, which defines the scope of coverage of defense, is the last part, which reads, with intent to defraud another of the lawful charges for the service. For the offense itself to apply to any of the factual circumstances that you referred to, it would be necessary for there to be a lawful charge that was imposed for the particular activity in question. And the activity that you're describing is someone who on their own acquires what is generally a large commercial satellite reception disc, and is able to stick that in some location in proximity to their home and receive for their own purposes basically what a cable company, for example, is going to receive for a commercial purpose. And it's my understanding in discussing this with Mr. Gorsuch, who represents, I believe, some of the cable interests in Alaska, that charges from interstate carriers that put out the signals that are picked up and then retransmitted are commercial charges. They're not charges that are imposed in the way in-state subscription services operate. For example, Visions in Anchorage, whatever the company is, Fairbanks, BC Cable here in Juneau, that the service you're describing is a service that's only sold to someone who's in the business of receiving and then retransmitting the signal to small home reception sets. So I think that the circumstances which have been raised by yourself and by Senator Parr simply don't apply there. I mean, there's no lawful charge that I'm aware of that's imposed or can be really imposed on the reception of that kind of a signal for your own personal use. By definition, then, there would be no intent to defraud another of that charge. So it would be my view that the language that's presently in the bill is sufficiently narrow to avoid that problem. I don't know how you would narrow it any further. I don't think that it would be advisable to try and build in geographic areas or anything of that nature. In other words, that it's within an area where subscription services are being offered for sale. So I guess in the final analysis, I really frankly don't see it as a problem.
Senator Parr?
Chairman, I understand Senator Hickey correctly. When I get back this summer, if I buy one of those big dishes and put it in my backyard, mm-hmm. pick up directly from the satellite, he's not going to prosecute me. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Senator Parr, you do represent an area that now with reapportionment, with not sure what area it'll be representing. But in some of the rural areas that are adjacent to Fairbanks, there may, particularly with the number of university-educated physicists we have from the University of Alaska, may well be, this may be more than just a theoretical exercise. Because
of, Mr. Chairman, I'm not certain how what the range of one of those outfits is. We're not talking about cable now. We're talking about the rebroadcast through the air, visions and spectrum in Fairbanks. In fact, I'm not sure what the range is. I assume it's about 30 miles.
I think that's
right. I don't know that. But we're not talking about cable. We're talking about that. And yes, what I'm hearing, though, is that even if you're inside that 30-mile range, you would not be covered with a signal.
I think that if you were doing what you were describing, sir, for a commercial purpose, you might well then fall within the...
No, I'm talking about your own individual use. You simply pull on your backyard and pick it up directly from the satellite.
Obviously, there's no way of knowing what kind of technology is going to be around 5 years from now or more in terms of how easy it's going to be to do precisely what you described. It may be what now costs $20,000 in terms of some kind of capital investment to have the luxury of sitting there and picking up 15 or 20 stations from around the world, actually. May 5 to 10 years from now only cost $1,000. And obviously that'll make a big difference in the nature of the industry. But I guess in the final analysis, the problem that the bill seeks to address is the problem we're all aware of. And the whole thing involves one of these examples of the extreme case where somebody is in a position and wants to invest in a satellite reception disc in their backyard kind of thing. I don't know that you can write statutes that take into account every potential eventuality, particularly when you're keying into an evolving technology.
Senator Clark, perhaps you could draft a letter for the committee, a letter of intent to accompany this bill as it's reported out.
It might be a good idea, Mr. Chairman, because this letter in the packets from Mr. Lane certainly implies to me that what he's looking for is something of the sort that would make it illegal. So.
I would assume that those people in various commercial enterprises would like it as absolutely as tight as possible. Mm-hmm. That appears not to be the intent of either the state nor indeed of this committee. So if you would hear that, Senator Clark, my staff would be available to be of assistance. Senator Holman informed me that if we wish to pass any bills from the committee, we would sign the reports having looked at the list of bills that were before the committee. But Dave, do you have any other questions?
Yes, sir. We see it very far last time. Necessity justification. I'm not quite sure what's being done here. I have read the commentary, by the way, so it isn't that. But as I understand it, when a criminal code was passed, the necessity justification said to the extent permitted by common law and didn't spell it out. Now what we're doing apparently is making it narrower than it was. Not being an attorney and not knowing what the common law permits, I find myself in a little difficult situation. That is on page 2 of the bill, if there's any question.
Sorry, Senator, were you finished?
Yes.
Did you have a specific question?
Yes, sir. I'm trying to find out what are we doing with this proposed change, because the original criminal code, as I understand it, simply says to the extent permitted by common law. Now we have said to the extent permitted by common law, we added a couple of more things to narrow that down, as I read this.
Which page? Line page 2?
Page 2, line 18.
Lines 8 through 18?
Necessity justification.
That is existing language, is it not, Mr. Hagel?
That all the way through
through 16, yeah. Through B.
Existing language. That's right. Yeah. The only change that's included in here is is a proposal to bring this defense into line with the other policy defenses. this one and
the mayor of the Senate defense, right?
Making it an affirmative defense. The defense itself would still key into the way the defense existed in common law. That's as I recall, dealt with a little more extensively in the commentary that went with the original criminal code. It's a very limited defense. It's generally not available in violent crime situations. I think, generally been held to be restricted to certain kinds of crimes, generally in a property area. But in any event, the common law has always defined the defense in terms of conduct on the part of the accused that's proportionally related to the nature of the conduct that's prescribed. Obviously, in almost any kind of factual circumstance, a person can argue somehow that his conduct was necessary. The logic of making an affirmative defense is that the defense itself involves activity that's peculiarly in the control of the defendant. What the law here is doing is recognizing that there are some circumstances where even though a crime has been technically committed, there are reasons to justify its commission and to excuse its commission. It doesn't negate any of the elements of the crime, and that's why it logically ought to be an affirmative defense. A defense that's a simple defense is one that goes to some necessary material essential element of the crime itself. And defenses like entrapment, duress, etc., are excuses really. They're excuse level defenses and not defenses that negate specific elements. And that's the reason for the proposal.
Does it make a difference is there a difference in the burden of proof between the way it would be without this bill and the way it is with this bill?
Sure.
The burden of proof switches to that to the defendant?
The burden of care of establishing a defense shifts to the defendant. That's correct, by preponderance of the evidence. But that's only after the essential elements of the offense have been established by the state beyond a reasonable doubt.
But what I'm asking, Mr. Chairman, I think the example was given in the commentary before, blasting a building when a major fire from spreading, or forcibly restraining a person infected with a highly contagious or dangerous disease. So, as I understand it, an existing statute, if you blasted this building to prevent a major fire from spreading, you have a simple defense. You can say, I did this. You still have to be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, right? But doesn't this section now put the burden on the defendant of proving that there was nothing else he could do except blast that building, or that had to be done, that was because of what he has to prove the necessity of that? Is that correct? The proof is, burden of proof is on him, not on the prosecution involved, am I correct?
Well, the burden of proof of establishing the commission of the offense remains on the prosecution, of course. The burden of establishing the defense of necessity would be on the defendant. That's correct.
Well, how is the burden of proof now not the
defendant? Well, the burden of proof now is the defendant would be obligated. He would carry a burden of persuasion, not necessarily a burden of proof, but a burden of coming forward with evidence sufficient to raise the defense, at which point the state would then carry the burden of establishing a lack of necessity.
So it does switch the burden.
On the question of necessity, yes.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about almost the crime, on the burden of proof.
It's not quite that clear. The state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a fairly heavy burden. Under the changes, the person who's charged with a crime would only have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that's
necessary.
Yeah, the defense is appropriate. So it's not a complete flip flop of. The burden of proof
is not the defendant doesn't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the evidence. But he doesn't have that burden at all under the existing statute. He doesn't have to put 51% on the existing statute. And I made the same comment some time ago on another one. We had the affirmative defense thing. I think like what we're doing is we're making changes to the criminal code, which we spent so much time adopting, we seem to be continually moving back to to putting more of a burden on the defendant always, and of course, along with increasing penalties and everything else, is a trouble with that.
Well, on this particular defense, Senator Parr, it was never that clear under the law in effect in Alaska prior to the adoption of the criminal code. The necessity was available as a defense. It's a very rare defense, and it's very seldom raised. It's very similar to duress in terms of the defendant's ability really to raise it. And again, what runs throughout the code with respect to most offenses of this nature is a finding that when we're talking about, number one, defenses that are excuses, and number two, defenses that involve matter that is purely in the possession of a defendant, that it's entirely appropriate that the defendant carry the burden of proof, but under a lesser standard by preponderance of the evidence. This subsection of the bill and the one dealing with the defense of insanity is reflective of that approach.
Mr. Hickey, the defense would most often be raised in crimes associated with property. Is that correct?
Senator Parr's example is a very good one. Generally, it's going to come about in crimes that involve some kind of a destruction of property, or taking of property, where the defendant is claiming that the conduct beyond his control necessitated his action, which technically amounted to a crime. One of the reasons, of course, why the defense is seldom, if at all, raised is that those situations where it's going to be applicable are generally sufficiently clear that a good deal of judgment is exercised in charging the defense in the first place, and rather than proceeding with the charge, some other alternative is worked out in those kind of situations. But our position on the matter is that there's certainly good reason to have the defense, but that recognizing what it's about and the logic of having it, it makes sense to treat it as an affirmative defense, and that's the preferable way to do it. Would you like me to move on?
Continue, Mr. Hickey.
Would it be productive to go through the rest of the bill, or do I?
I think both Senator Parr and I have been through it. Senator Parr, there are other items that you wish to raise in the bill, other points that the defense believe we should discuss.
Nothing, Mr. Chairman, and this has come up before, and I'm not sure where it was, but it seemed it was last year or past the year before. Top page 3, line 4. I don't think there's a good definition here, and if I've missed it, it might be evidence solely of an abnormality which is manifested only by repeated criminal or otherwise, any social conduct is not sufficient to establish a criminal defense. And I worked in this field before in the Judiciary Committee, and the same thing was brought before us. I've forgotten in what context or by the department. And there was general skepticism, which is the use of a term called like antisocial. It's too vague, it's not defined in the bill unless I've missed it somewhere, which I might have. And antisocial conduct, I guess it could be spitting on the sidewalk. And you might spread disease. I can think of a lot of things that are really not a danger to public safety, or to the danger to the public as a whole, or to society, and which society has a right to protect itself against, but which are, might be called antisocial. Now, there's a definition of that which is sufficiently restrictive to indicate that this antisocial conduct is something which is harmful to society as a whole, and a problem, but I haven't seen that definition yet. I might point out, by the way, this was not simply my reaction, this was the reaction of the Judiciary Committee in general at the time I had it before. Antisocialism is basically.
Mr. Hickey?
I'm not sure how to respond. I don't understand the question, sir.
Well, the question, sir, is that...
Isn't there a better term?
We're talking about a defense on the basis of someone, mental defeat, disease, or defect, excluding responsibility, right? Which also an affirmative defense, bottom page 2. But then you get to section B on top of page 3, and this abnormality is manifested only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial conduct is not sufficient to establish the affirmative defense. Right. Now,
Are you disagreeing with that proposition, Senator?
Well, what I'm wondering about here is just if it's, you say repeated criminal conduct doesn't give evidence of an abnormality which commits that affirmative defense. I've got a problem. You know, what are you talking about when you say antisocial conduct?
I see.
You see, and this is an undefined term which may mean one thing to you and a different thing to connect to me and something else to Senator Rhodey. And it should be, if we're going to use that term, otherwise antisocial conduct, we're going to have to define it.
Well,
and though it's defined, I don't know whether I like it or not.
Sure. In the context of the way it's being used, i.e. as applied to the defense of mental disease or defect, it has a psychiatric meaning, as I understand it. And this language is generally reflective of the language that's presently included in the insanity provisions that are found in Title 12 of the statutes. But it's a term that has meaning within the general set of criteria and guidelines that psychiatrists rely on to diagnose people within the context of criminal offenses where the defense of insanity has been raised. And all this section does is say that evidence of repeated criminal behavior, repeated antisocial acts, things of that nature, are not sufficient to establish the defense. It's necessary in order to establish the defense to have evidence that supports a finding of a major mental illness, that as a result of which a defendant is unable to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. You're right. If the term was being used to define criminal conduct, it would be obviously a very troublesome term. But on the other hand, the way it's being used here, it seems to me that it's being used in its most appropriate and commonly understood sense. And in any event, whatever that understanding is irrelevant because the thing that you have to rely on to either establish or not establish the defense are psychiatric findings and psychiatric testimony. And it has obvious relevance within the context of a particular individual situation to a psychiatrist who may be examining it.
What you're saying, Mr. Hickey, I guess if you strike subsection B, you couldn't. You're going to rely on a psychiatrist in any event.
Well, you could, Senator, but I would advise strongly against it. I think that we want to make it clear that evidence of repeated acts of antisocial behavior are simply not going to be sufficient to raise the defense of insanity. The point, of course, is that
I might agree with you, Mr. Hickey, if we knew what antisocial behavior is. Now,
can you think of anything that could fall in here that ought to give rise to the defense of insanity that could conceivably be excluded?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose if every night that the moon was full, I would go get 2 gallons of red paint and carry one in each hand. I walk down the street down here, and every building that has a number 13 on, I throw red paint on the door, right? And I presume that would probably be considered antisocial conduct. I presume that any reasonable person would probably say that was a little bit off my rocker, too. Now, I'm
right.
Asking if you want an example, right?
Okay. Do you want, as a matter of public policy, for evidence of simply that, nothing else that goes with it, but simply that every time when the moon is full, you get a couple of gallons of red paint and throw it on every 13th house to be the sole evidence that results in a finding of insanity?
You ask for one example, Ms. Pickford. If you only multiply that, I could do that on the night when the moon is full, I do this. When there's no moon, I do something else. And at high noon on every Sunday, I do something different.
All right.
Maybe a whole pattern of this, right? And you simply ask for one example. Now, I guess, the way I look at it in criminal cases, and I'm not talking about civil, that's a different story. In criminal cases, the law should be as clear-cut and as explicit as possible. The primary function of the trier of fact is to be a trier of fact. Right? Did the person do this or did not do that, right? That's what we have the juries and the judges for. But the law itself, it shouldn't be, to the extent possible, we should not have a court having to interpret what the law says in criminal cases. Now, if we want to keep antisocial conduct in this bill, I don't have any trouble if we define it, and I can accept the definition.
Let me raise it. What we're doing is actually keeping antisocial conduct from being considered at least the sole evidence, and you never know how a court will interpret this, but I think it would, will do a great deal towards ensuring that eccentricities will not be relied on, certainly not very heavily, as evidence of mental disease. At least that's the way I read it. And I'm not quite sure what antisocial means either. I'm also not sure what we might use as a differing term, undesirable or.
Why not define it, Mr. Chairman?
That's the other alternative. Appears to be a relatively Herculean task as well.
Well, I don't have any particular quarrel with that. I don't believe it's necessary. I think it does have a commonly understood meaning. This language is not that language that requires any interpretation or construction by a trier of fact. It's language that is placed in the statute to provide guidance to a trial court in ruling on the admissibility of evidence and the sufficiency of evidence to establish or not establish a defense. And again, it has meaning within a psychiatric connotation, which is what's important when you're talking about the defense of insanity. If the simplest approach to this whole subject is to do what some other jurisdictions have recently done, and that is eliminate the defense of insanity. The reason the criminal law becomes very complicated is because we inject, at times, sometimes unnecessary, very complicated propositions into it. Insanity is one such proposition. There's no constitutional requirement that insanity be available as a defense to excuse conduct, and it would be perfectly permissible to repeal the defense altogether and to make the matter of a question of disposition and sentencing. However, as a matter of public policy, I think that the approach that's set out in this bill is a preferable approach. But I think we want to be careful in defining the offense to make it very clear that evidence of bad acts of and by themselves are not going to be sufficient to establish the defense as a matter of law. And it has nothing to do with what a trier of fact is going to find.
Further questions on that point, Senator Farr?
Mr. Chairman, I do not feel I'm going to be able to, with all due respect to you, to both move this bill out. It's a question of taking the time on it.
Fine.
We ask you if you would get a quorum of somebody else to move it out.
We will take.
I'm not getting answers to satisfy me. I'm sure you satisfy me. Dickie, they may satisfy you, but they don't satisfy me. So, I'm not going to feel comfortable with it.
I understand that. Be more than happy to take some additional time on this bill. Perhaps the appropriate thing to do is at our next meeting, is again perhaps when we have a full committee deal with some of the questions that you have raised as well. Perhaps we can have some additional research done posing some alternatives to that particular point.
Other questions, Senator, that I could respond to at this time?
I have none at this time. Senator Farr?
No, sir. I think.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jones, did you wish to testify as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just on one section of the
one wall. Please come forward.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Walt Jones, Assistant Director of the Division of Corrections. And I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood that the Division of Corrections is interested in page 4, line 19, which increases the presumptive sentence amount from 6 to 8 years. And I want to make sure the committee understands what the Division of Corrections estimates this means to us in terms of convicted persons doing more time and resources that we think we'll need in order to take care of this change of law. And those resources are pointed out in the position paper and fiscal note. And I'd like to amend the fiscal note where it says fiscal year 84 to $4.3 million rather than $4.1 million. And there's a $200,000 mistake. We're estimating that the difference that amount of time for 32 persons would be 48 man years at the maximum and 24 man years at the minimum, which breaks down into that we're going to need 48 more beds at the maximum or 24 more beds at the minimum. Now, the maximum and minimum is based on whether how many aggravating circumstances are admitted in court or how many mitigating circumstances are admitted, or perhaps a combination of both. Now, the minimum amount of funds needed would be $2.1 million to build the necessary beds. The fiscal year 86 block of $1.9 million represents operational expenses. In other words, we think it would take us, from the time we receive the money, 2 years to bring those beds online. Those beds are estimated at $90,000 per bed, rather than $135,000 per bed, because we plan to add those beds to our existing court facility rather than build a whole new court facility. By court facility, I mean common services that prisoners would use, such as food service, laundry, recreation, whatever. We wouldn't have to build those services again. I don't have any more comment unless the committee has questions.
Do you have any questions, Senator Farr?
Just a moment, Mr. Chairman. I'm not quite sure I understand. In your position paper, Mr. Jones, and you repeated this a minute ago, more or less, we calculated there'd be a prison population increase of 48 man years. Is presumably your population increases in the increments, right? Not all at once.
That's true.
So, when you say 48 man years, is that over a certain period of time?
Yes,
or
sir.
Is that the total impact it would be? Or I'm not quite sure I understand.
Yes, we've tried to figure that in there. And let's say this is year one. Mm-hmm. And that this law would, or this act would become, would impact us. We figure we'd need 48 beds, additional beds than we have now, to handle the increase that this bill suggests in the prison term for this type of offense.
You need 48 more beds, and that would be an ongoing thing, and once you've got to 48 beds.
Right. This amount and these beds are over and above anything that we have projected or planned because of other bills suggested for the present revision.
Right. You see, his term 48 man years, and that's what I guess.
Yeah, that equivocates to 48 beds.
48 beds, each one filled all year long.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. That's enough clear enough.
Thank you very much, Walt. If there are no further questions, we will lay Senate Bill 535 aside for the time being. I've got some people at a meeting in my office now, since we don't have a quorum, and there's no possibility of getting one. I think we'll just adjourn again. Given the events of the day, the Judiciary Committee will adjourn.